You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Cypriots hold their breath as their government works on a controversial bailout plan that could take money from everyone with a savings account. We'll have the latest. And as we mark the 10-year anniversary of the start of the Iraq War, we sit down with the current chairman of the UK's Intelligence and Security Committee, Sir Malcolm Rifkind.
It has become clear that the public and Parliament itself is now much more sceptical when ministers, sometimes with good justification, refer to intelligence being clear as to a particular threat facing this country.
Plus, as Samsung races against Apple to create the first so-called smartwatch, we find out how Swiss watch manufacturers are responding. We also sit down with the mayor of Greece's second city, Thessaloniki, to find out about their ambitious plans to beat the recession.
We want to make Thessaloniki the center destination for young people from all over the world. Come down and open up. Create things, do things, cultivate their hopes for the future, give them chances to do things.
And one of Russia's greatest living novelists, Mikhail Shishkin, will be joining me in studio to talk about his new book entitled The Light and the Dark. All that, plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the news headlines with Paul Osborne.
Monocle 24 News, there's still substantial public anger at the levy on bank accounts in Cyprus, despite moves to exempt savers with the smallest deposits. Those holding between 20 and 100,000 euros still face a charge of almost 7%. On higher deposits, the levy rises to 10%. It's a condition of an EU bailout of Cypriot banks, but it won't happen unless the country's parliament approves the measure. Andres Charalambos from the Cypriot Ministry of Finance says their opposition has been made clear.
Let me be very clear that we have opposed politically and technically to the proposal on the table. The President and the Minister of Finance were absolutely, absolutely clear that this approach would have very detrimental effects on the economy.
Exactly 10 years after the start of the US-led invasion of Iraq, a series of bomb attacks in and around Baghdad has killed 50 people and injured almost 170 more. They targeted Shia areas, including markets, restaurants and bus stops. Islamist Sunni militants have threatened to step up attacks on Shia targets to try to provoke sectarian conflict in Iraq. Government forces and rebels in Syria have accused each other of firing chemical weapons. Syria's state news agency claims 25 people died in an attack near the northern city of Aleppo. A body monitoring the use of chemical weapons says there's no evidence they've been fired. At the White House, spokesman Jay Carney says the reports are being investigated.
We have no evidence to substantiate the charge. That the opposition has used chemical weapons. We are deeply skeptical of a regime that has lost all credibility, and we would also warn the regime against making these kinds of charges as any kind of pretext or cover for its use of chemical weapons.
Zimbabwe's new constitution has been approved by an overwhelming majority of voters in a referendum. It limits future presidents to 2 5-year terms. Almost 95% of voters backed the text, paving the way for elections later this year. 7 U.S. military personnel have been killed in an explosion at an ammunition store in the state of Nevada. It happened during a training exercise at the Hawthorne Army Depot. At least 7 more men are in hospital, 3 with serious injuries. At his inauguration mass, Pope Francis has called on world leaders to protect the poor and the weak. Around 200,000 people were in St. Peter's Square earlier for the formal installation of the new pope, but that's around 1/5 of the number police were prepared for. Kishore Jayabalan from the faith-based Acton Institute think tank says Pope Francis must get to grips with the Vatican bureaucracy.
The Pope's evangelical mission cannot take place if he's always dealing with scandals. So naming his administrators, his staff members, especially the Secretary of State, is going to be very important. His second big challenge will be proclaiming the gospel in a world that doesn't know as much about Christianity or religion in general.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Paul. It's 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Cypriot officials are working on the controversial bailout plan in a bid to limit the damage to small savers from measures intended to seize up to 10% of all bank account deposits. A parliamentary vote on the measure opened 2 hours ago, but it's unclear if it will be effective as many parties, including the ruling party of President Anastasiadis, have threatened to abstain. Cypriots have been outraged since they woke up this weekend to find an unprecedented EU bailout agreement meant anyone with money in a Cypriot bank account would have a percentage seized in order to secure an international deal to save the Mediterranean island from default and banking collapse. Joining us on the line with the latest is Dr. James Kerr Lindsay from the European Institute at the London School of Economics. Thank you very much for joining us. The vote seems to have be stalling because it doesn't seem that any MP feels that they can back this and hope to stay in power, I guess. What do you imagine is going to be unveiling in Cyprus tonight?
You know, it's one of those strange situations where it's almost impossible to tell. I'm really actually struggling to find the words by which to describe what we're seeing there. You know, this story has really snowballed over the past, 72 hours since the news broke on Saturday morning. And I think that the level of anger, indignation in Cyprus is reaching levels that, you know, unprecedented levels. I think the only other time we would have seen this was a couple of years ago when there was a major explosion that was caused because of storage of ammunition, which did tremendous damage, and there was a lot of Cypriots went out on the streets. You know, but this is really this has galvanised Cypriot opinion in a way that I've not seen before.
Now, there's been a lot of finger pointing today. I think in Cyprus, people have been saying it's the EU and it's the IMF's fault. They're saying actually, you know, the Cypriots themselves chose this as a solution. The Russians are saying if you touch any of our money, we won't back the loan that we've already offered to Cyprus. Do you think this is really unraveling now?
Yes, I mean it absolutely looks that way. I mean, I think one of the things that that has many people have found offensive is this argument. Well, you know, the Cypriot government imposed it on the people. It certainly wasn't as simple as that. I mean, people often forget, you know, Cyprus is a hub for business services and banking lies at the very center of that. You know, the danger was that if all the burden of this was put on depositors with over 100,000 euros in their account, they would have paid the tax and then they would have got out. And that would have absolutely destroyed the Cyprus economy. So the government actually realized that, look, it had to keep it below the psychological threshold of 9.9%. And that meant having to share some of the burden at lower levels. And I think that, you know, Cypriots are willing to accept in some ways that what they haven't been willing to accept is this idea of even taking money in the first place, that this just goes against everything that had been promised to them, that it seemed that they were being punished because certain European Union leaders had it in their mind that Cyprus was just this haven for Russian money laundering. You know, I think that this is really what is affecting public opinion there. They feel that they're being punished, and it's fundamentally unfair at all sorts of levels.
Now, regarding that Russian money, it's created this phrase, overbanked, the idea that there's just, you know, too much capital sitting around in Cyprus's banks. And apparently some 40% of that money held on deposit does belong to foreigners, most of them Russians. And let's be honest, lots of them probably are trying to dodge tax and keep money outside the country without having to pay tax back in Russia. But if this money is pulled out of the country, it does threaten Cyprus in other ways, I would imagine, because, in fact, it would signal an end of all confidence in Cyprus's banks by outside savers.
Well, I think, yes, absolutely, it has a major effect. But also, I mean, it's likely that a lot of companies will pick up and say, look, we just can't take the risk. I mean, you know, the effect that this bank closure is having on ordinary businesses and a lot of the foreign businesses based in Cyprus, because all bank accounts are being frozen at the moment, and access, you know, this is actually having a major effect. And I think it's also important to recognize that, yes, you know, we talk about Russian businesses in Cyprus. We talk about Russian deposits and that somehow some of the, you know, most of them are shady. I take issue with that. I think, you know, you would find, you know, as has been pointed out to me by a number of people today, you know, doing business in Russia is extremely risky. Cyprus is a safe haven. You know, it operates essentially under British law. You've got very good lawyers. You've got very good accountants. It's a very effective and efficient place usually for doing business. And, you know, when you look at this and you think, you know, the danger of expropriation, for example, in Russia and punitive taxation, that a lot of honest businesses, I think, are getting have put their money into Cyprus. I think you can replicate this in any number of other countries in the region, and that this whole reputation of Cyprus has built up now for being a safe haven, but not necessarily in a negative way, is now in jeopardy.
Now, there's been some talk today that they could perhaps kind of ease the situation by raising the threshold on which you would pay any tax at all on bank accounts. I think Reuters has been carrying a story today that they've seen some papers that suggest it would be 20,000 euros would be the initial point at which you would pay any money at all. Now, just in the numbers game, I presume that cuts out all the kind of, you know, grannies with a few euros in the bank. Does that actually diffuse the situation if they could go that route? Or is it just really the very heart of this issue, taking money out of people's bank accounts that it won't be put up with?
Well, I think it there would be an element of both. I think, you know, certainly part of the sting would have been taken out of it. But, you know, it will still leave a lot of people in a very, very bad situation. And, you know, there are a very large number of foreign expatriates from Western European countries. I mean, Britain, for example, many, many Brits have retired out to Cyprus. You know, they might have sold up their house in the UK, put that money into a Cyprus bank, sort of made their calculations for their retirement on that basis, and now they're being stung for this. And I think, you know, you can see that as well in many Cypriots that, you know, have put some money away. And, you know, 20,000, yes, it's going to help some people. But, you know, I think you're going to find that the middle class is still going to be hit very, very hard by all of this.
And finally, now I'm going to give you the world's most impossible job. I'm going to make you finance minister of Cyprus. What on earth can you do then if this falls apart? Where is the wriggle room?
Oh, you know, I'm going to back out on this one. I'm going to say I work mainly on the politics of this problem. I am so grateful that I'm not an economist at the moment. I can look at this and sort of say, look, you know, this is having a terrible effect on Cyprus and its standing in the world. But, you know, how you sort this out, you know, I just have no clue. I think, you know, this is going to be exercising a lot of people's minds in the coming hours and days.
Okay, we'll let you keep your job at the LSE for the moment. That was Dr. James Kerr-Lindsay from the European Institute at the London School of Economics. Coming up, we look at the 10-year legacy of the war in Iraq.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dan.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchley.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of their best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide on Monocle.com.
And welcome back. It's currently 18:14 here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck and you're listening to Midori House. Now, today marks the 10th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. All this week on Monocle 24, we're speaking to those involved in the conflict and its legacy, from war correspondents to policymakers to the generals in charge at the time. In today's instalment, airing on the Monocle Daily tonight at 2200 hours, London time that is, Alad John meets with the Britain's former Defence and Foreign Secretary and current Chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, Sir Malcolm Rifkind, about how the war has changed the world's views on intelligence gathering.
As Chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, how much do we think there was a disregard for advice and intelligence gathered at the time from academics and the intelligence community?
Being frank, I think there was a tendency in a number of quarters to give more weight to that part of the intelligence assessment that happened to reinforce views that were already substantially held, and less willingness to consider such evidence as pointed in the other direction. I think also I would make two criticisms of the way intelligence was used at the time. I think, first of all, intelligence by itself is rarely sufficient justification for going to war. It is rarely as reliable as you would like it to be. It deals often with circumstantial evidence, and it should be at best an additional item that is before ministers, together with both open material and deep analysis, not only of the benefits in the short term of using military power, but also what the long-term political and strategic consequences might be. So I think that is part of the criticism. I think also, I speak specifically in the United Kingdom, which I'm more familiar with the background, I think some of the people at the head of the intelligence world were a bit too close to ministers and too willing to try to accommodate them. I don't think they did that in bad faith or for improper reasons. But, for example, what's become notoriously known as the dodgy dossier, the intelligence document, which was produced at the request of government to provide the intelligence material such as it was that pointed to possession of a program of weapons of mass destruction, that was, at the request of government, printed in the name of the intelligence agencies. The first time, and I hope the last time, that any document is produced by the intelligence agencies themselves. I say it was a mistake, and it's been acknowledged by Mr. Blair that it was a mistake. It was a mistake because that is no function of the intelligence agencies. They are not there to argue a point of view or even to involve themselves in the public debate. They are there to provide information and, where appropriate, analysis of the intelligence material. It is for the politicians, for the ministers, if they wish to use that material to argue for a particular political objective in public, to do so in their name and not try to gain a bogus respectability by having it printed in the name of what are essentially civil servants.
Bearing that in mind then, how big a game changer has Iraq been in terms of politics in the UK, policy, gathering of intelligence, and for the judiciary itself?
I think, first of all, the decision to go to war on what were always very controversial grounds and which turned out to result in some very serious consequences is the single most important reason why we now have an Act of Parliament in place requiring parliamentary approval before Britain would normally go to war. That's not always possible if it's a sudden attack on the United Kingdom, but where the time exists to invite Parliament to express a view, that should always be done. Now, to be fair, Tony Blair did have a vote in Parliament, but of course that vote took place at a time when all the troops were already in the Middle East and when it would have been incredibly difficult for Parliament to reach a different decision. So I think that's part of the consequence. I think also it has become clear that the public and Parliament itself is now much more sceptical when ministers, sometimes with good justification, refer to intelligence being clear as to a particular threat facing this country. Let me give an example. There is a continuing issue of the policies of the Iranian government and whether they are seeking to acquire a nuclear weapons capability and perhaps actually create nuclear weapons. Occasionally, ministers will say, and I personally think they're entitled to say, that the intelligence evidence is overwhelming, that is indeed what Iran is seeking to do. Not surprisingly, there is a lot of skepticism in Parliament and in the public, and you will often hear people saying, well, that's exactly what you said about Iraq, and it turned out to be pretty ill-founded. So I think we are continuing to pay the price. That will get less and less as the years go by.
A price that is not necessarily a negative thing, though, more scrutiny and attention to detail that perhaps would prevent the rushing through of acts of force.
Of course, that is right. But you see, I mean, taking the Iranian example, it's a case in point. what successive governments have been seeking to do in the case of Iran is quite different to what happened in the case of Iraq. No one has been even remotely suggesting we should be sending American and British troops to invade Iran. And indeed, this particular problem has gone on for a very substantial number of years. There is a potential military option which may have to be considered by the United States, but that would be limited to some air attack on Iranian nuclear capability. Nevertheless, the point I'm making still remains entirely valid, that regardless of the amount of intelligence material that might exist pointing to Iranian culpability, many people remain skeptical, saying, well, this is the kind of argument we heard in the case of Iraq, which turned out to be unjustified. So why should we believe it when it's used now? And that's applied in a number of sectors.
Well, that was Sir Malcolm Rifkin talking to our Alid John. And you can hear more of that discussion on the Monocle Daily from 2200 hours tonight. And we've got more coming up in just a moment. Now, these are very tough times for Greece, with the country stuck deep in recession. In Thessaloniki, the country's second city, Mayor Yiannis Boutaris is facing high unemployment rates, a sometimes uneasy ethnic mix, and the legacy of municipal corruption. His predecessor has just been given a life sentence for embezzling 18 million euros from the city. Boutaris is something of a maverick, especially for this conservative region. A 71-year-old tattooed, chain-smoking former alcoholic with a gold stud in his ear. He ran as an independent in the 2010 elections. Since then, he's won praise for his unorthodox, straight-talking style and his reforming zeal. Monocle contributor Daniela Pellet sat down with Boutaris and started off by asking him, with the country in crisis, if there was anything the municipality could do to improve life on a local level.
There are not many things that could be done unless one thing is done. Delegate authority. I'll tell you why. For example, if you want to have a bus lane, strictly for buses, up to 6 months ago, it was a dual ministerial decision for a bus lane in Saloniki. So you understand, I sometimes feel we are joking when we say that you have a mayor of the city. A mayor is not needed for openings and feasts and things like that. A mayor is needed so that he can ameliorate and facilitate everyday life, which cannot be done unless he has the authority. And the mayor doesn't have the authorities that he should have. So the point is that unless the way of thinking and this centralization of everything, get it in Athens, the central government, unless this changes, nothing is going to change.
So what do you think are the greatest challenges currently facing your city?
Saloniki has an unemployment percentage of 27%, which is almost the highest in Greece, and an unemployment of 60% for the young people, which is disastrous. At the same time, Saloniki is a student city. It has three universities, an international university, two newly founded 5 years. And we got more than 120,000 students living in Saloniki. This is why Saloniki is so live, music groups, theater, other activities that come from within unorganized initiatives of young people. This is the reason we had this application for Saloniki being the youth capital of Europe for 2014, and we gained it. So Saloniki is the youth capital of Europe for 2014. We want to make Saloniki the center destination for young people from all over the world. Come down and open up, create things, do things, cultivate their hopes for the future, give them chances to do things. I think this is the heart of Saloniki. Saloniki is not anymore, it used to be tobacco center, cotton center, knitwear center, industries, everything, but now this is gone. The only thing that we have in our hands is education, plus the new technologies. So we have to find a way to marry these things.
Saloniki has a very multicultural past. How do you see that as part of its present and as part of its future?
Universities, young people, and the past is the only true treasures that we have. You cannot build your future unless you know your past. Knowing your past doesn't only mean the churches and the Autobahn buildings and the ancient things we find through excavations. It means that we must learn how they live together. When Saloniki was liberated in 1912 from the Ottoman Empire, which was falling apart, Saloniki had 50,000 Jews, 30,000 Turks, and 20,000 Greeks. And the order of the central government was make Saloniki a Greek city. Saloniki was what they called Jerusalem of the Balkans. There were 12 newspapers, all languages, Greek, Turkish, Jewish, Italian, French, English. We have now only one. We have to understand how they live together. Saloniki also had the exchange of population in 1922. We had about a million Greeks who came from Asia Minor. Many of them stayed in Saloniki and they were dispersed all over Northern Greece. This was a big change in the structure of the society. Then we had the Holocaust. Nowadays, we have, after the falling apart of the Soviet Union, we had Greek Russians who came down in Saloniki. We had immigrants from Albania mainly. There are 70,000 Albanians living in Saloniki only. And they are already absorbed in the society. We have more than 10,000 Armenians, Greek Armenians, who came down from Armenia. So we've got to find ways to integrate all these ethnicities and make them live together, because now they are afraid. The Greeks are afraid what they're going to do here now. They came and they steal our jobs and they do things like that. And people who came from all over, you see a doctor cleaning a room because he cannot find a job as a doctor. So we have to overcome these difficulties. If we do it, then we'll be an example of people living together, because it really doesn't matter if you come from Senegal or from Afghanistan or from Russia or wherever. You decide to live here, we have to find ways to live together.
Well, I'm not quite sure where he's the mayor of, because he could be the mayor of Thessaloniki, Thessalonica, Saloniki. They have lots of ways of pronouncing it. But anyway, his name is Ioannis Boutaras, and he was talking to Monocle's Daniela Pellad. Well, the news is next, and that's going to be followed with an interview here in studio with the acclaimed Russian author Mikhail Shishkin. To get us in the mood, this is from Russia. This is Tatiana Kokarev with Roses. That was Tatiana Kokarev with Roses.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Were you London? This is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour on the programme, we'll be talking to Mikhail Shishkin about his new book, and we'll take a sneak inside the new upcoming issue of Monocle magazine. And we'll also find out what the new smart watches are going to look like and how Swiss watch brands are responding. But here with the news and with some breaking news from Cyprus is Paul Osborne.
In the last few minutes, the parliament in Cyprus has rejected proposals for a levy on bank accounts in the country. It's a condition of the proposed bailout of Cypriot banks worth 10 billion euros. The European Union has said that bailout payment won't be made unless the country's parliament approves the measure. Ministers had tried to change the proposal to win political and public support, saying those holding less than 20,000 euros would be exempted from the levy. But, as we say in the last few minutes, the parliament has rejected the plan. Other news. Exactly 10 years after the start of the US-led invasion of Iraq, a series of bomb attacks in and around Baghdad have killed at least 50 people. Almost 170 more have been injured in attacks which targeted Shia areas, including markets, restaurants and bus stops. Both government forces and rebels in Syria have accused each other of firing chemical weapons. The Syrian state news agency says 25 people died in an attack near the northern city of Aleppo, but a body monitoring the use of chemical weapons says there's no evidence that they've been fired. 7 US military personnel have been killed in an explosion at an ammunition store in the state of Nevada. It happened during a training exercise at the Hawthorne Army Depot. 7 more men are in hospital, 3 with serious injuries. And plans for a new constitution in Zimbabwe have been approved by an overwhelming majority of voters. The referendum saw almost 95% of voters back the text, which will limit future presidents to 2 5-year terms. Though that rule won't apply to the current president, Robert Mugabe. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres,
Nova York, Tóquio. London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
You're back with the Midori House on Monaco 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. Picture two people, young and in love. Picture them being separated from one another. Picture them keeping their love alive through letters. So far, so simple. Now imagine that they're not just separated geographically, but also historically. Imagine that their love and their letters now defy time and place, life and death. This is the plot of Light and the Dark, the latest novel from the acclaimed Russian author Mikhail Shishkin. It's only been out a month and already it's made Russian Literary Prize history and to date has been sold in 22 languages. Mikhail joins me now in studio, as does Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound. Welcome, Mikhail. Thank you very much for coming in to see us.
Now it's 26 languages.
Okay, I'm sorry.
There's a man who's keeping count.
We're slow with the breaking
news. The contemporary author. Yeah.
Just tell me, first of all, Mikhail, why did the format of letters appeal to you so much for this book?
Because for me, the tradition is very important. And what could be more traditional than love letters and a letter book? And I think every young writer wants to make something very special in his literature, to put the literature in the future. But you can't do really anything new if you don't use what was before you. That is why, for me, the Russian tradition of novel, the Russian literature of the 19th century is so important. And in Russian, it is «писемовник». The very beautiful title. It's a very old word, from the word письмо. Письмо means letter, and письмо, the second meaning, is writing. And in the 18th century, there were really bestsellers. So the collection of letters, how to write letters, for example, how to write love letters, the collection of the best love letters. And that is why in Russian I have this title, but I was sure all countries have, all languages have the same beautiful word. Nothing of the
of
kind.
Of course not.
And all publishers in all countries make their own title. For example, the French, they entitled the book Deux heures moins dix, so 10 to 2, because it is in my novel. The father gives us a present, children watch, where it's always 10 to 2. It's the symbol for eternity, yeah? And the English publisher wanted to connect to the tradition of great Russian novels like War and Peace.
It's got that kind of
punishment, and now The Light and the Dark, yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Mikhail. You mentioned the Russian tradition. How apparent are this? And we should say also that The Light and the Dark, your novel, or the letter book, to give it its Russian, proper Russian name, maybe, translation, sort of travels through time and space. It's got a sort of postmodern structure to it as well.
No. It's quite simple. There is just two types of time. Yeah. The false time, which we are living in, yeah, and the genuine time, yeah, the real one time. And this false time I call the journalist time, because everything which is happening now here is going to die the next second, you see. And the symbol of this false time is the newspaper, and everything what we think is important comes today in the newspaper, but tomorrow it is the newspaper of yesterday. And the yesterday's newspaper and the symbol of death. Yeah, of death. And what can a writer do, an artist? He could pick the most important things from this false time and take with him into the real time, to the genuine time, where everything passes, goes at the same time, and there is no death. There is no death, yeah? And this is the space and the time of the art. That is why we need the art for this space.
And I want to ask you about that. I wondered how it is a Russian novel,
And we use that word with a capital R and a capital N. The Russian novel means something to everybody all around the world. You're one of the great exponents of it in today's world. How keenly do you feel the ghosts of, you mentioned 19th century authors, Dostoevsky, Pasternak, Tolstoy, breathing down your neck, Mikhail?
No, what is actually the Russian tradition?
Yeah.
It is not to entertain. Yeah.
There's a
the
sense
Russian
of seriousness.
Tradition is
yeah.
to ask some serious questions. Mm-hmm. And maybe knowing that there is no answer to this question, just try to ask them, try to discuss them. Yeah. And actually, I think every Russian writer writes the same novel, but answering the same questions. That there are no new questions. They are just the same. For me, I started when I was maybe 7 years old. I was in the vacations in the summer house with my grandma. And we went to the railway station to buy some stuff, and we saw on the street the dead cat. And all passed by, but my grandma went back, took the shovel, and she buried the cat. And for me, it was the first time this shock. God, will my beloved grandma die like this cat? All people I love, like my mother, my brother, myself, will I die like this cat? What to do with the death? And so the only possibility for me to answer this question is to just to write. But when you are 16 and when you're 50, you have the same question, what to do about that? But you have different answers. That is why sometimes I write new novels.
Mikhail, can I ask you, obviously, all great Russian authors have come out of their time. And recently you were quoted as saying that you didn't want to go to an American book fair to be the representative of Russia. You felt that you had some quite harsh things to say about what was happening politically in Russia. Are these novels rooted, do you think, in the politics of today in Russia?
I didn't say that I don't want to be representative of Russia. I don't want to be representative of that official Russia. You see, we have just two different Russias now. I said that I want to be representative of my Russia, which is free for imposters, which has free elections, which has free media, which has free people, yeah, and that Russia, which we get all the time from the news, especially in the last months, it's disgusting, it's absolutely humiliating, and me as a Russian citizen, I feel absolutely humiliated by this regime, and I don't want to represent it in any way.
But there is one of the good things about Russia, Mikhail, presumably, is how well they treat their novelists in a way. There's a proper scene in Russia. In Russia, novelists are regarded like maybe we regard rock stars, with a bit more seriousness, as you say. But there's a proper scene. When I went and I hung out with, I think, a friend of yours, Irina Prokhorova, she was telling me that novelists are lauded, and it's certainly a scene in a world, isn't it? Which maybe from traveling around you've noticed is maybe different to how authors are regarded in the US or the UK, perhaps?
Why? Really, the writer is something special in Russia. I think because a writer never depended on sales in Russia, because he never depended on readers. Before the revolution or after the revolution, the most popular books were forbidden books. It was impossible to buy them, so a writer didn't write for selling the book. Yeah, it writes because he must answer some questions. Yeah, for himself, without thinking, will it be published? Will it bring him a lot of money or not? Yeah, and
I was also going to ask you. I know that you're a man who's a bit itinerant these days. You pace yourself a little bit in Switzerland, a little bit in Germany, a little bit in Russia. You're here now. Is that for your writing or for your personal freedom? How come you've found yourself in so many different places?
No, I think everybody must live not only in his own country, and especially the writer, because if you spend your whole life only in your country, it's like living in a house without looking glass, without mirrors. And if you spend some years in another culture, in another country, it helps you to understand yourself better, your country, your history, your language. And so, because my second wife was Swiss, it happened that now I live between Russia, between Moscow, Switzerland and Berlin. So...
It's a happy triangle.
Yeah, a very happy triangle.
I have one last question for you, Mikhail, which is your characters in the book, Volodenka and Sasha, are they kind of universal characters? I mean, they're fleshed out characters clearly in the book, but is the idea, it's one of the ideas that they are kind of universal, and it is their letters and the feeling and the love and death that they have to come to terms with that is more important maybe than their characters, than the plot of the book as well?
No, Sashenka and Volodnenko are actually Adam and Eve. Yeah, and they go their way to the wisdom, and every takes his own path. She represents our banal way to the simple wisdom. So everyday life, getting married, getting kids, divorce, death of your parents. Yeah, and he, as a man, has the privilege, unfortunately, to have a short way to the same wisdom through the war. The men have the possibility to feel what is death. Yeah, in 18, like my father, he was 18 when he had to go to the war, the Second World War, and he was on the submarine 44, 45 in the Baltic Sea, and this experience just influenced all his life. Was alcoholic, yeah. But my Volodya in the book, like my father, yeah, when they were in teen, they already got this wisdom. What is important in this life? Important is the family. Important is the human warmth. Important is to have children, yeah. And a normal guy with 18, it's impossible that he wants to have children, yeah.
Yeah.
And that is why people in my book, like, you see, I describe some soldiers at home. They were rude people. They beat their wives. But in the war, they write warm letters.
Yeah, right.
My beloved, yeah. He would never say this, yeah, at home.
Mikhail, can I tell you, you say the book is now in 26 languages. You obviously speak some of those languages. When you crack open the book, when you read it in English, and you know what the Russian original was like, do you sometimes read it in another language and see something different in the way that the story unfolds?
What translation really is, I realized when I got from my publisher 3 sample translations in English, made so 2 letters from the book translated by 3 different translators, and no sentence was the same. No sense. It means every translator could translate just another book. I would have 3 different English novels with different titles.
It's a crazy thing. I'm interested in the subtlety of translation. I think this is Adam Bromfield, isn't it? That translated.
It's Andrew Bromfield. And of course, I try to work always with my translators. But what can I do? I could just help the translator to understand everything what understands every normal Russian. Yeah, but I can't struggle like I struggle against my Russian language. I can't struggle with Andrew Bromfield against his mother tongue. So I just must leave him alone and hope, yeah, and pray that he will win.
Sounds like you've helped Andrew write the great Russian novel.
Not this Andrew. Anyway.
Not this Andrew, Adam Bromfield.
Mikhail, thank you so much for coming in to see us. That was the author Mikhail Shishkin telling us about his new book, The Light and the Dark, and also Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound helping out there in the background. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up, we're going to have a look at the business pages in the upcoming issue of Monocle magazine, and there's a discussion on Samsung's foray into the world of watches.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week shows for an hour of essential listening.
A fair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24, brought to you in association with Rolex.
You're listening to Midori House, and it's 1848 here in London. Now, every day on Midori House this week, we're going to give you a sneak peek inside the upcoming issue of Monocle magazine, which hits newsstands around the world on Thursday. Today, we're looking at the business section. Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson visited the ancient perfuming town of Grasse to find out how the art of scent creation is changing and how it stayed the same also. Tom joins us on the line now from Paris. Hello, Tom.
Good evening to you, Andrew.
Good evening, and I'm sorry you've been kept waiting, but it was by a Russian great, so I think that's slightly allowed to happen. Now, you headed down to Grasse, which is famous around the world as the home of the great fragrances. Now, how is that city coping with the challenges from other markets and from the industrial processes? Is it holding on to its power?
It certainly looks that way, because Grasse has got a sort of a stamp, if you like, a seal of approval and a brand that other up-and-coming parts of the world that produce all these ingredients, these beautiful flowers and other exotic things that end up in the perfumes and the scents that we buy, they can't compete on that. So the sort of the romance factor of this is a town that's been doing this for generations and generations is something that a new market, one of the emerging markets like Bulgaria or Morocco that also produce these flowers for fragrances, they can't compete on that. It's like a wine in the Bordeaux area. You know, it's got a picture of a chateau on the bottle, and it's got something that even if the content is the same as something that comes from the New World, it's in another league.
Now, I thought what was interesting about your business story is that the generational element. You know, there still are kind of young kids who want to learn what their parents and their grandparents did.
Absolutely. And the whole town, it seems like every one of the 53,000 people that live in Grasse is somehow involved in the perfume industry. And I was just puzzled when I met people, and I was meeting one person in one what I thought was totally unrelated business, also in perfumery, though, and I saw their family name, and I'd meet another one with the same family name, and I'd ask them, are you related? And they'd say, well, of course we are. That's my father, or that's my cousin, or whatever it is. So everyone seems to be passing on this sort of this savoir-faire of making very fine perfumes from generation to generation. So lots and lots of examples of exactly that sort of handing down the generations. And the weird thing was, which I didn't know when I went there, was that this all began with the leather industry, which was very big in that part of France, and it was the fashion to have very smart leather gloves, but they had a horrible smell. So all the great old perfumeries there, they started life as tanneries that men made these little oils that went with the gloves or with the bag or whatever it was, was bought to make it smell rather less rancid. So that's not such a romantic beginning to this industry.
But some of the inspiration for the fragrances that are being made today, as I look through your story, there's some kind of wilder kind of links. That it's not all about flowers, is it?
No, we met a perfumer whose scent is inspired by a mechanic's workshop. I really like this one. It's called Cambouis, and in French that means sort of grease or oil, sort of grimy oil that you might find on the pistons of an old car. He's made it based on what it smells like when you get into an old car and in a garage, and it's sort of got the smells of leather, and you can almost smell the engine of a classic vehicle when you smell this scent. So that was a very interesting one. But I think the key thing to the whole town and what it contributes to the sort of top-end fragrances is these natural ingredients that a lot of them come from around there, like the mimosas that were in full bloom when I was there, and lots of other flowers too, like roses and violets and everything else that all end up in these scents. I think they're still the key, though, ingredients to everything that comes from grass and ends up in the bottles of scents that we buy, but I mean the very top end.
Now, don't taste the wrong way, but have you smelled better since you got back then?
I actually was given a little bit of stick by one or two co-presenters at Monocle when I was last there, who said that my passion for Middle Eastern fragrances perhaps had got the better of me. And I even had a dab hand at making one when I did a report earlier for Monocle in the year at L'Artisan Parfumeur, which is a perfumery in a school here in Paris. And I think it was Hugo MacDonald on his Section D program who said it reminded him of his late grandmother. So perhaps I did learn a thing or two when I was there about what perhaps I should be aiming for, and it's probably rather different from where I was before I went on that lovely trip to Grasse. It's a beautiful town. I really recommend a visit if you can go there.
Good. Well, I hope we see you in London soon doing some presenting too. That was Monocle's Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess Watson. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. There was a period when that beautiful timepiece around your wrist would have a solitary purpose, to tell the time. If you were lucky, they were usually handcrafted by some of the most skilled watchmakers on the planet, usually hailing from Switzerland. But with the advent of the smartphone and more integrated forms of technology, the wristwatch has been evolving. Apple is currently in the process of designing a new watch that will incorporate many of the features traditionally associated with the iPhone. Now it looks like the South Koreans are getting in on the game as well. Samsung has said that they will develop their own version of a wearable smartphone. But does all the high-tech hype actually translate into watch lovers ditching their timepiece for a smartphone that they can wear? Joining us is Oliver Chen, Citibank's luxury research senior analyst, and also we're going to be joined in a moment by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Oliver, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, I guess the slight worry for the Swiss, even though they seem in robust health at the moment, is that when digital watches came along a long time ago, it did shake the industry up for a few years because younger people got so carried away with, you know, these kind of digital watches that they really did knock the industry for six. Do you think there's any potential for that to happen this time?
Thanks, Andrew. I do think that people do care about electronic devices, and it's capturing a lot of mind share. But I would say that the Swiss watch heritage, the craftsmanship, the branding, and the fashion remain very important, sustainable competitive advantages, especially because the potential product offering of the smartphone type of watch seems very different from, say, buying a Patek or an Omega.
And what do you think will be the market for these watches? Do you think that there is going to be a kind of a younger generation of person that will want them?
I do. I feel like, you know, even in daily life, you see very, very young kids who are enjoying iPads. And so the kind of young to teens will definitely be a important addressable market. What's good for the marketplace at large, though, is just anything on the wrist. And these devices are likely going to be very different, you know, from a Rolex or from the fashion angle or from the passing on for generations angle, but having something on a wrist is a good thing for the watch market at large.
I'm joined also by Tyler Brulé, who's actually just been visiting some of the Swiss watch companies today and who is in Switzerland as we speak. Tyler, thank you for joining us. You may have heard me there just reference what did happen when those digital watches first came out. And for some reason, they did shake the industry, the watch industry, the traditional watch industry. When you were going around seeing watchmakers today, do you think that they have really kind of moved into a very different part of the market and they're so robust now that they won't be threatened by any of these activities and won't certainly be tempted to copy any of them?
Good evening from Geneva, Andrew. I think it's a very good question. And having spent time actually with the likes of Rolex and Patek at length today, I don't think that they're, you know, particularly bothered. And when I brought this up, I said, "Oh, you just see the news about Samsung in line with Apple. You know, no one's really paying attention to these things." Of course, Basel World is coming up. You know, they're much more concerned about their stands and, of course, all of the major pieces that they're going to be premiering. I don't think it's really hit here. And I think that, you know, the 1970s, the rise of the digital watch, you know, the challengers that came from Japan, you know, was maybe a moment in time. And I think also we've arrived at a very, very different place right now. I think where we have emerging economies, it's a very, very different luxury landscape. So I don't think people are too terribly concerned.
Oliver, just returning to you quickly, you did reference the idea that anything that's around the wrist is good. Do you think that we've seen there is a problem for all the watchmakers? Is that there is a kind of generation of people, just as they've given up on their televisions, they have slightly given up on the watch itself. There's a lot of people, I even noticed one or two, unfortunately, around this office, who never have anything strapped to their wrist. They seem to look at their phone when they want to know the time.
Well, we've seen actually tremendous growth in the watch market globally. So there's been a few, 2 to 3 years of double-digit growth, 2 years of 2020, then 10, even, you know, having cell phones. So I feel like these can be, you know, comfortable bedfellows. And even in the United States, you know, the Michael Kors $250 watch, it's become an iconic fashion item, which is a powerful kind of statement. And so I do see like the ability for there to be both.
And Tyler, just cutting to you, you know, we've seen Samsung doing some very interesting things in the phone market recently, and just in the last kind of 20 seconds, do you think that they are really kind of raising their game and challenging the likes of Apple in a way that we've not seen before?
Well, I think the interesting thing to watch with Samsung is obviously Korea is a serious luxury market. And the one thing that wouldn't surprise me is if you actually see Samsung leapfrog over Apple and do something very interesting with materials and really understanding a luxury consumer, maybe more than Apple does.
Tyler, thank you so much. That was Oliver Chen, who's Citibank's luxury research senior analyst and Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.